to The Weekly Input by myself, Liam Kelly, where I discuss key political and economic issues that are happening in the world right now. Today, we're going to be going over Biden's COVID-19 plan and his legislative strategy so far and how it's going to affect us in the future. First, we're going to start with a quick COVID-19 update. 100,460,000 cases have been reported worldwide, with 2,400,000 deaths being reported worldwide. In the United States, we have 25.8 million active cases, with 432,031 deaths. Now, you see, for some reason, this has been highly contested, and lots of different people will tell you lots of different things. Everybody has their own opinion on it, but the United States has been hit harder by COVID than a lot of other nations. Now, I'm not going to sit here and compare the United States with countries like Iceland and New Zealand, you know, that because it's completely unethical to do so because it's completely incomparable. However, there are decent arguments to make when you say that a centralized plan of, first off, vaccination, but not only vaccination, because vaccination is only a half of the picture. If we're talking about actual what happened back in January when things spiked, we're talking about communication problems. We're talking about responses. Because vaccinations weren't really the problem back then. Sure, that would be a quick solution, but it wasn't what was causing people deaths. The deaths were being caused because hospitals were getting full. It's because people were ordering the wrong types of equipment. And it's because, for some reason, Democrats and Republicans alike thought that ventilators was the political go-to, even though it turned out that ventilators didn't actually help that much. So we had ventilators sitting in a warehouse because, guess what? We messed up. We put our foot in our mouth. We screwed the pooch, and that's what happens, okay? So yes, I agree with some of what Fauci says when he says that a centralized system of response would have benefited us. This is true. However, if we look at places like New York, places like California, who have had pretty centralized responses, right? We see negative effects. I mean, California has been getting absolutely hammered, while other states who haven't gone that centralized route have done pretty well for themselves comparatively. Now, we shouldn't get caught up on what could have been or what we should have done. I mean, that's a lesson that we can use. However, what we should be focused on is the plans that we have in front of us now and the future, what we should do, what politicians should be enacting. So let's go over the Biden plan, right? At least pieces of it. Biden's COVID-19 plan, called the American Rescue Plan, is a $1.9 trillion legislative agenda. One of his staff is quoted saying, "It is a decisive economic response that starts with emergency paid leave for all those affected by the outbreak and gives all necessary help to workers, families, and small businesses that are hard hit by this crisis. This will require an immediate set of ambitious and progressive economic measures and further decisive action to address the larger macroeconomic shock from this outbreak." Now, today I'm going to go in depth into what this actually includes and whether or not that statement is actually true. All right, first, the basic idea of this entire plan, the basic premise that he's going after, is that he's going to put money into the economy and it'll increase consumer spending. Increasing consumer spending will translate to an increase in personal consumption, obviously, which leads to higher GDP and we can all go home and drink smoothies. All right, obviously not. There are holes in there. At the same time, that's a good thing. I mean, it's true economically speaking. However, other economic trains of thought disagree with that, and we'll look into those too. But first, let's go over the main plot points of this plan, all right? First, he provides most Americans with a $1,400 relief payment, bringing the total value of the second round of relief payments to $2,000, all right? So these are checks to American citizens, all right? Then he increases weekly federal unemployment benefits to $400 a week and extends them through September. Unemployment benefits is something we are going to get into on a whole different episode, all right? Because that topic gets into the whole nature of the welfare state, and that is just too deep a topic. However, in this situation, like usual, I bet you guys can guess, I'm actually in favor of the unemployment benefits just because it's a global pandemic. Regular economic rules do not apply, and you guys will understand why I say that with this specific bill later on in this episode, all right? Next, he provides $20 billion to scale up the nation's vaccination capacities, $50 billion for testing, $30 billion for the disaster relief fund, and $10 billion for domestic pandemic supplies manufacturing. I'm all for it. All for it. All for it. Scale it up, all right? We got to be like New York with the smallpox virus. I've been saying this for a while now. We got to increase spending for not only for the nation's vaccination supplies, because that's great, but we need distribution infrastructure, and we need it fast, all right? So that's great, all right? He then creates 100,000 new jobs in public health to aid testing and vaccination efforts and reduces unemployment. I like it. It's good. It's good. Okay. It's good. And I'll tell you why. We'll get even further into it after this. But see, I am all for whenever government wants to make jobs in order to lower unemployment, especially in a pandemic like this. You make jobs for people that you need people to work in those jobs. You're going to need them anyways. You make those jobs or you buy things from people who will employ people. I mean, that is just, that's basic good government. All for it. 100%. All right. Next is he wants to invest $130 billion into helping schools reopen safely through the implementation of social distancing protocols, improvements in ventilation, and other steps. Ventilation is a big one. Not a lot of people are talking about ventilation, but ventilation in small, you know, enclosed rooms has actually been shown by scientists to decrease the risk of exposure to COVID by a great deal. All right, so that's actually huge, okay? He then expands paid leave coverage to 106 million Americans. All right, we're just going to keep going. I'll talk about it in a second. And then we get to the big banger, all right? The big banger. All right, I'm sorry. I'm just rubbing my face. It hurts me, you know? I mean, not really. You know me. I love government spending. But still, seeing all this, man, those are a lot of numbers, all right? Jeez. It also includes a permanent, here it comes, increase to the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. Whew. Okay, first of all, okay, let's be honest, folks. That's not happening. That's not happening. We can say it's going to happen, all right? We can smoke whatever he's smoking. Even with the majority, there's no way he's getting that through. No way he's slipping that dime in there. I mean, I'm all for it, personally. All right? I'm all for it, personally. Well-intentioned $15 minimum wage. You know, I am all for that, all right? The studies have shown, the only studies that we've done is Seattle. We've done Washington, all right? And the problem with that is, I mean, if you look at the UK, there wasn't hyperinflation when the $15 minimum wage went up. Unemployment, there wasn't mass unemployment. These are myths. These are myths, all right? If you want to talk about the Seattle study, because that's what people love to bring up. They love to bring up Seattle. They say, oh, the Washington study, right? They measured Washington. They measured Seattle. No, it's bull, all right? Seattle was growing faster than any city in Washington. The study only did cities in Washington, okay? While the boom was happening, okay? It didn't pick up the minimum wage. It picked up the boom. Like, this is common. There are so many economists who agree with me on this. And, I mean, this is just basic common sense, right? Just look over the study. The study is just crap, okay? It doesn't make any sense. You look at UK studies, I mean, it clearly shows that the minimum wage did not increase unemployment, okay? I just wrote a whole article about it. You guys gotta go watch it on the Weekly Input, all right? It will be in the comment section down below. You guys should totally check it out. Why the minimum wage matters. You guys definitely got to check it out. It has everything to do with, you know, monopsony and buyer power. And you just read it, okay? Because we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about the Biden plan, right? All right. Now we get into the bad, right? Because there is a lot of bad, right? Now, I will be the first one to say that this plan erects a pop-up welfare state, all right? Instead of a permanent one. And if you're going to do a welfare state, you got to get close to a permanent one. If not, then you're wasting your time. I think that definitely, you definitely don't want government dependence, because that is a bad thing, a very, very bad thing. There's a difference between government help, there's a difference between government regulation, and government dependence, right? So I think that that's a bad mistake, all right? Next part of this is some of the well-intentioned policy initiatives are just flawed in their core. They're just bad policies. They're not, you know, bad-willed policy. It's not like they're meant to hurt anybody. They're meant to help people. They are just poorly written, and whoever wrote them should be fired because they're bad. You should get someone better, all right? Through its increases to the CDC and the EITC, the Biden plan aims to provide income support to parents and working-class households, obviously, right? I mean, that's obviously what they're doing, but dispensing aid through tax credits rather than through the provision of direct cash benefits is substantively and just politically flawed, all right? Means-tested tax credits require eligible households to identify themselves, all right? This shifts a logistical burden from the government to citizens, and it's completely unnecessary. And those most in need of help often fail to shoulder that burden, all right? According to the IRS, only 78% of eligible tax units receive the EITC benefits that they are entitled to. And that's because they don't identify themselves. They don't take on that burden. And according to the census, non-participation in the EITC is skewed towards low-income families with children. And those are the people that need our help most right now, okay? I mean, so those are just some, those are some logistical and just some policy errors that are just bad. Like, that's common sense stuff. You should, come on, man. All right? I mean, that's Bush League, okay? That's a simple mistake and it shouldn't have happened. All right, but overall, the bill isn't bad. The plan isn't bad. The American Rescue Plan overall isn't a bad plan, actually. It's got some flaws. It's got some policy initiatives that certainly could use some polishing. But in essence, it's not bad. So let's look at the overall economic outview of the entire situation. Now, this idea, the concepts that the American Rescue Plan builds itself up on is a school of thought called modern monetary theory. And a lot of Democrats and left-wing economists have been moving towards modern monetary theory, or MMT, right? Modern monetary theory, created by American economist Warren Mosler, bears similarities to the older schools of thought like functional finance and chartalism. Chartalism being a non-mainstream monetary theory that defines money as a creation of the government that derives its value from its status as legal tender. The central idea of MMT is that governments with a fiat currency system under their control can and should print as much money as they need to spend because they cannot go broke or be insolvent unless a political decision to do so is taken. They adopt an older view known as the endogenous money theory that rejects the idea that there's a supply of loanable funds out there that private businesses and governments compete over. Instead, MMTers believe that loans by banks themselves create money in accordance with market demands for money, meaning there isn't a firm trade-off between loaning to governments and loaning to businesses of a kind that forces interest rates to rise when governments borrow too much money. MMT goes past this even and argues that the government should never have to default so long as it's sovereign in its currency. That is, so long as it issues and controls the kind of money it taxes and spends. The U.S. government, for instance, can't go bankrupt because that would mean it ran out of dollars to pay creditors. But it can't run out of dollars because it is the only agency allowed to create dollars. It would be like a bowling alley running out of points to give players. Basically, modern monetary theory says that the classical approach to economics, that the only responsible way to govern is to take taxes that cover your spending costs, or that taxes are only to be used to cover government spending. That's how classical economics works, right? I mean, that's what we all grow up learning. However, MMT, you know, flips the board on that. MMT says that there is a near unlimited supply of money because the agency that controls it is also the agency that spends that money. Therefore, they cannot run out of money. Now, I know what you're thinking. Hyperinflation, right? What about Zimbabwe? What about Venezuela? Well, MMT has an answer for that, right? MMT says that taxes can actually be used to combat hyperinflation. Now, don't just listen to me on this. We're gonna get further into this, okay? But first, let's go over some cons to MMT first. Let's hear the counterargument, right? One of the main counterarguments is that MMT has a flawed model of inflation that overestimates the importance of economic slack. MMT argues that economic slack, or the amount of resources not being used at a given time, is the determinant of inflation. The origin of this argument is partly based on an economic model entitled the Phillips curve. This model put forth the claim that there is a trade-off between the unemployment rate and inflation, meaning more of one will lead to less of the other. However, there is evidence from studies in the 1970s that speaks volumes to the idea that high inflation and unemployment are simultaneous. Most naysayers towards MMT would say that inflation is caused by monetary policy and not slack. The second main argument against MMT is that it drastically overestimates the revenue that can be earned from money creation. It's common practice that a government can only earn revenue from creating currency, or rather printing money, if the cost of printing is less than its value. If a $50 bill costs 7 cents to print, then it yields $49.93 profit. When you take into account that the government does not pay interest on that money, it will be quickly spent by the public at large. This leads to hyperinflation for not much added revenue. Other arguments against MMT include that it overestimates the ability of fiscal authorities to control inflation, and that it contains too few safeguards against the risks of excessive debt. However, MMT has a response to these claims. Stephanie Kilton, who is a professor at Stony Brook University, was recently on the popular NPR podcast Planet Money. This is what she said when asked if putting even more money into the economy might lead to higher inflation. Well, Where is it? She says. We've been doing it. We just did it with a $1.5 trillion tax cut. We did it with $300 billion in additional spending. We've done it and done it and done it. Where is the inflation problem? I don't see it in the UK. I don't see it in Japan. I don't see it in the US. End quote. The thing is, guys, she may actually have a point. Inflation has been low in the US and other developed countries. And while fiscal policy doesn't determine inflation in those economies at the moment, it doesn't mean that the concept doesn't necessarily work. Kelton goes on to say that taxes should be used as automatically fluctuating economic tools, much like unemployment insurance. When the economy is booming, we don't have to spend as much on unemployment insurance because it automatically fluctuates with the state of the economy. Kelton says that we should do a lot more of that and that taxes should be the next step. Conservative economists have genuine concerns about this theory, though, because for decades, economists have argued, like I said, that the only responsible thing a government should do is to use taxes as a way to pay for spending, obviously. The end hope of this being a balanced budget. However, when you look at schools of thought like MMT, an automatically fluctuating taxation system makes sense. For one, it protects against hyperinflation while allowing the government to spend a lot more money. It also, in large part, removes taxation from the political realm altogether. That is important because when politicians control the tax rate, they don't want to increase them because it threatens them during re-election. That's actually a huge point against MMT, usually. A common argument against MMT is that taxes don't work like that. While taxes can be used to fight inflation, they're not. Why? Because people don't want high taxes. However, an automatically fluctuating tax system solves this problem in large part because it's not high taxes. They're relative taxes to the state of the economy. Okay, if the economy is in bad shape, then we may need more taxes to increase that, right? To increase the GDP and aggregate demand. It's the same thing if the money supply. If the government starts spending too much money, then taxes are a way to take some of that money back, right? If the economy is doing really well and taxes aren't needed as much, then you pull some of those taxes back. I mean, this is an actual solution to that problem, right? However, there are cases of governments pressuring central banks to create money to finance fiscal debt. Examples of reckless fiscal policy generating inflation include, as I said, Zimbabwe, Argentina, and Venezuela, where central banks are far less independent than the Federal Reserve. Paul Krugman and other MMT critics have warned that money finance debt could lead to hyperinflation. As Krugman wrote in 2011, when people expect inflation, they become reluctant to hold cash, which drives up prices and means that the government has to print more money to extract a given amount of real resources, which means higher inflation, etc. Do the math, and it becomes clear that any attempt to extract too much from seigniorage, more than a few percent of GDP, probably leads to an infinite upward spiral in inflation. In effect, the currency is destroyed, end quote. Once again, this claim raises some questions from MMTers. For one, the United States is much stronger economically and institutionally when compared to, say, Venezuela. Also, America is the sole executor and agency of creation of the currency that it uses. Not to mention that if new money out of thin air creates inflation, then why was there no inflation when Ben Bernanke created $1 trillion in assets to save the banks during the financial crisis? And by the way, $1 trillion is the low end of that estimate. With a lot of economists, including a paper by the Levy Economic Institute, argue that the cost was as high as $29 trillion. I mean, Japan runs a deficit of 240% and yet all has almost zero inflation. In fact, new money creation is an extremely common event, and hyperinflation is a relatively rare event. The Business Insider is quoted saying the Japanese deficit implies that the government has spent an amount of money greater than the entire value of the Japanese economy, but has not been able to take in enough in tax revenue to cover it, and is thus full of debt. Yet the inflation rate in Japan is currently negative 2.9%. That's negative inflation, end quote. There are many examples of this situation in the modern world and throughout history. The fact of the matter is that MMT concepts can be seen in the American Rescue Plan through and through. There is one thing for certain that I can promise you guys, and that is that these concepts have been gaining speed and we shouldn't expect them to die out anytime soon. Economists and politicians will be debating these ideas more and more, but one thing that we can all find comfort in is that the left is finally coming back home with actual liberal economics instead of Marxist economics. Round of applause, please. Thank you. All right. The days of Bernie Sanders have come and passed. All right. Now let's move on to Russia. All right. throughout the Trump administration, phone calls and meetings between President Vladimir Putin and President Trump, as we all know, have been kept in what we can only call Al Gore's lockbox, right? I mean, communication with the press on these matters was non-existent. Access to the president about these meetings was unfathomable. And the only real information the American public received was that which the Kremlin released. For 4 years, the American public has heard one side of the story, which is the Russian side of the story. President Joe Biden has begun a series of powerful political maneuvers directed towards the Russian government. I mean, really, guys, it's a sight to see, okay? Just yesterday, the White House released an entire in-depth transcript of the president's call with President Putin of Russia. The White House press release is quoted saying they discussed both countries' willingness to extend New START for 5 years, agreeing to have their teams work urgently to complete the extension by February 5th. If you're unfamiliar with the New START nuclear arms treaty, then you should know it is a big deal. The Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs is quoted saying New START is key to international stability and crucial for ongoing work on arms control and disarmament, end quote. The two presidents also are reported to have agreed to explore strategic and stability discussions on a range of arms control and emerging security issues. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm actually pretty happy that the executive branch of the United States government has finally found a microphone in that White House somewhere, okay? Because I love hearing about this stuff, and for 4 years, we heard absolutely zilch, okay? I mean, while it must be stated, okay, we can't ignore the fact that Trump did do some big stuff in the fight against Russia, all right? Such as arming the people of Ukraine with deadly weapons, all right? That's huge. But most, if not all, of the weight of those policies was nulled out by election tampering and the threat of conspiracy with a foreign entity, right? I mean, the Biden administration seems to be taking much greater steps in putting forth strong policy when it comes to Russia. And those are just the facts. I mean, the report doesn't stop there as, quote, he, being President Biden, also raised other matters of concern, including the SolarWinds hack, reports of Russia placing bounties on United States soldiers' heads in Afghanistan, interference in the 2020 United States election, and the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, end quote. I think most of us can agree that this is great news, and I think it truly shows an end to the spineless foreign policy of the Trump administration when it came to Russia. Let's talk more in depth about the last part, though, specifically the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, right? Navalny is the leader of the Russia of the Future Party and a founder of the Russian nonprofit organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Sounds just like Putin's man there, right, guys? Putin must be a big fan of this guy. And while this party is yet to be formally registered by the Russian Ministry of Justice, its political activity and ideologies are in stark contrast to that of the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the ruling party of the United Russia. And I know that surprises everybody, right? Because Putin is a man of honor, trust, and the dude has never, ever, the corruption isn't even in his dictionary, man. Get that out of here, right? Navalny was tailed by a Russian agent and tricked the agent into revealing he was poisoned in August, which it turns out was through a lethal nerve agent entitled Novichok planted in his underpants. Navalny posed as a senior official from Russia's National Security Council who was tasked with analyzing the poisoning job. The agent, who had just traveled back to Omsk in Siberia to try to clean up evidence, revealed his identity to Navalny. When Putin was questioned about this incident, his response was in pure Putin fashion. If he wanted him dead, quote, it would probably have happened, end quote. Truly, the words of a benevolent tyrant, folks, I know. The guy's a great guy, okay? The effect of this incident is that the streets of Moscow have been filled with rioters, 20,000 exactly, who are tired of the corruption in Russia, all right? During these protests, common chants can be heard such as, Putin is a thief, and we will not leave. Moreover, protesters have begun throwing barrages of snowballs at police officers. Police officers have responded to this all-out lethal artillery, right? Because snowballs, those are deadly, by arresting 3,000 Russians across 100 cities. Oh, and don't worry, folks, it does not stop there. There is a report of a cop kicking an elderly woman in the stomach, leaving her sprawling in the snow in need of medical attention. Why? Why would a member of the Russian police do such a thing in Moscow? Because she had the audacity to politely ask why the cops are arresting people. I have only 3 words to say on that. God bless America. I just want to thank you guys for listening in to the weekly input for today. You guys definitely need to subscribe and stick around for our next episode where we will be discussing the minimum wage and all of the political and economic ramifications that go along with it. You guys definitely do not want to miss this. This is Liam Kelly. This is the Weekly Input. I will see you guys next time.